You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although it may feel like the Iraq War has gone on forever, it's quite surprising how few movies have been made about it. In the wake of Taxi to the Dark Side, The Kingdom, and In the Valley of Elah, now comes a film that concentrates on a completely different aspect of the war, the day-to-day experiences of the crews who patrol Baghdad streets and defuse IEDs, the improvised explosive devices. The Hurt Locker has been directed by veteran filmmaker Catherine Bigelow and written by Mark Boll, who also created the story for In the Valley of Elah. It's already won awards at the Venice and the Toronto International Film Festivals, received almost universal rave reviews, and now it's being shown at the Landmark Sunshine and the AMC Lincoln Square here in New York. I'm really glad that it brings both Catherine Bigelow and Mark Boll to our show. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Considering the low interest at the box office for the other films, did you have trouble raising money for this one, Catherine?
No, actually not at all. The script was so compelling, and we financed it completely independently, kind of outside the industry, and shot it in the Middle East, and we were kind of off the radar until we popped on the scene in Toronto.
Well, you've made some big movies. Have any of them been studio films?
Technically not, although studios have stepped in early on in the production, but this one we decided to sell when we were completed.
Even though this requires, I'd imagine it required a fairly big budget, because you have all these explosions and stuff. Really? A teeny budget?
It's modest.
No big stars.
Modest.
Other films have had big stars. Is that usually what eats up a major portion of the budget?
Oh, so many things. I mean, you're from production design to above the line, which is all the salaries, to shooting days and all the, you know, the vagaries of production. But in this case, it was a kind of lean, mean machine, and all located in the Middle East, which helped a lot because, of course, it's a movie about the Middle East. And
you shot it in Jordan?
Shot it in Amman, Jordan, very close to
the border.
Iraqi border. And one of the great bonuses of shooting there were the Iraqi extras who were refugees from the occupation. About 750,000 live in Amman, and some of whom are actors. So that was kind of a great win-win scenario.
Now, Mark, when were you embedded with the U.S. Army Bomb Squad?
That was the end of 2004 and into the beginning of 2005 in Baghdad.
So that during the roughest time, more IEDs exploding than at other times.
Yeah, I think looking back on it, it turns out to be one of the hotter periods of the war. The squads that I was kind of embedded with and would go out on missions with them every day would have to defuse about somewhere between 10 and 12 or 10 and 15 IEDs within a 24-hour period. And so there were literally hundreds of bombs going off every day in Baghdad.
Incredibly stressful. Is one of the reasons that not much has been written about bomb squads before because reporters recognize how dangerous it might be being near these guys?
I don't know, really. It was striking to me that here you had this unit that was the critical tactical unit in the war. It had clearly become a war of IEDs at that point, and clearly the army was relying on the bomb squad to deal with them because no other soldier had really had the right training, and yet nobody knew that even the army had a bomb squad. And part of it, I think, had to do with the fact that the bomb squad has historically been very press shy, and some military units have better PR operations than others.
And why do you think that is?
Maybe it's due to the fact that a lot of their techniques are very classified, and they don't want, they don't want exposure to the sort of mechanical engineering aspects of the job. But it's also just temperamental. The Navy SEALs tend to be much more outgoing. The Army Rangers, have been pretty good at grabbing their share of headlines. But it's also because historically, bomb squad has not ever played such a critical role before.
Well, I heard a report this morning on NPR. The IEDs are changing. They're not using metal anymore, so now they're getting bomb-sniffing dogs to locate the bombs. But these guys come across as being almost like surgeons, only with a lot more danger involved.
Yeah, except if they make a mistake, they die. They don't lose the patient. So there is a lot of dexterity involved, and there's a lot of intelligence involved, which is also sort of makes them interesting from a character standpoint. You're not simply dealing with a newly minted frontline grunt. You're dealing with somebody that has a fairly high IQ in order to be able to get into that position, and at the same time has an extraordinarily unique ability to exercise that IQ under very stressful conditions. And that's kind of a genetic thing that can't be taught and is fairly unique to the bomb squad.
But there's also a strong psychological component here, and I suspect that was one of the things that attracted you to this, Catherine.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that you have these individuals that have arguably the most dangerous job in the world, and yet it's a volunteer military. So they choose to walk toward what I would say most people on the planet would either walk away from or run from. So I think that's a really interesting psychology that Mark beautifully crafted in the script, and Jeremy Renner, Anthony Mackie, and Brian Garrity play beautifully.
But even in the film, we get the feeling not everybody agrees on how dangerous it should be, and there is disagreement within the squad as to just how much of a cowboy you should be. Do you think of yourself as the ideal director for a project like this? How does it fit in with your previous films?
Well, I'm not sure about, you know, how it fits in necessarily, because each time I sort of look at each film as a universe in and of itself, and distinct and a complete departure from what's come before. And I'm always drawn to characters. And that starts the whole process. And so in this case, it's exactly those characters, the Jeremy Renner character.
Well, but you didn't receive a script. Mark wrote the script on spec, didn't he? So
correct.
How did the project come about?
Well, I knew of his journalism before he went to Baghdad. And then when he came back, he told me these extraordinary stories. And I think it was a kind of...
Well, you knew each other?
Yeah, prior to. I knew of his journalism and knew him prior to his embed. And then when he came back, I think it was our combined and shared interest to kind of examine these characters as a film.
Had you seen In the Valley of Elah?
Yes, yes.
No, not at that time.
Not at that time. That was much later.
It didn't exist yet. I was working on that with Paul Haggis when we started talking. By the time that came out in America, we were in Jordan.
Yeah,
we didn't actually see that until
production.
Several months after it came out, because we were in Jordan shooting this one.
So when you discussed coming up with a script, I assume that you not only talked about what you might want in this film, but what you might want to avoid.
I don't know if we talked much about, other than classified, unclassified. That was kind of critical.
Well, some of that, but I think we also, we talked a lot about avoiding a certain kind of theatricality that is present in all sorts of movies, but particularly in war movies, and keeping it very realistic and repertorial and naturalistic.
Yeah, so it almost has a documentary feel.
Yeah, and wanting it to be very raw and immediate and visceral.
And you said experiential.
And experiential, exactly. So in other words, you're giving the audience a sort of boots on the ground. You are there, look at Day in the Life of Bomb Tech. But that was really the focus of our
conversation. Yeah, except when people say documentary feel, I think that is a tiny bit misleading, because in a documentary, of course, you're really constrained by what you're able to capture in the moment. And in a film, you can create what's going to be maximally entertaining and maximally dramatic, and then make it look like you just happened to stumble on it. But that was what we talked about all the time. If you could be God and create the ultimate documentary and be at the right place in the right time, what would that look like? And that's what we tried to do.
But yet at the same time, have it feel as if it's unfolding before your eyes for the very first time and has never been contemplated before.
It's also a reason that the film doesn't have an overt political message, because we're really with these people just doing their jobs day in and day out.
Yeah.
You're nodding your head. This is radio, Kat.
I think that's right. We didn't want to have people sort of stop their normal life and turn to the camera and give a speech to articulate a position that maybe wouldn't be...
Oh, why are we here in this stupid war?
The thing is, the soldiers have actually fairly complicated and interesting points of view about those kinds of questions, and are as boned up on international geopolitical issues as anybody that works for foreign affairs, because they're living it. But they're not usually talking about that kind of thing when you're standing over a bomb. And you're not usually talking about who you voted for when you're getting shot at. You're saying, pass the 9mm. You know, you're not saying, well, how do you feel about Proposition 8? So we tried to really capture the gritty life of it and leave the politics to the politicians.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, provide an opportunity for an informed opinion. You know, here it is. This is as authentic and realistic as we could possibly create, given that it's based on 2004 with as much specificity as possible. But, You know, so that was really what was the overriding principle. And also provide an opportunity to remind people that today, even as we're having this interview, there are men and women who are out there walking toward what most of the world would run away from.
My guests are Catherine Bigelow, producer and director of The Hurt Locker, and Mark Boal, who's also a producer of the film and the writer. It's now playing at the Landmark Sunshine and the AMC Lincoln Square. I mentioned, Mark, that you did this film on spec. That's always a rough thing to do because there's no guarantee that you're going to get paid or that the film is going to be made.
Yeah, that's true, but it's no guarantee when they pay you either that they'll make it.
Yeah, there are guys who just write films. There are people who write films and make a nice living, and the films never get made, but what the heck?
Yeah, but, you know, when Catherine Bigelow calls you and says, I think you should write this as a script, it's kind of a hard one to say no to. And it actually, funnily enough, in terms of the course of the movie, the script was written on spec, but all the way down the line, people worked on this movie for a fraction of what they normally get paid, and I think that's why it looks bigger than actually the budget is, and from every department, from special effects to music to editing, you have people that were coming off Spider-Man, coming off $250 million pictures, working for, you know, the price of a tuna fish sandwich in order to really try to make something, you know, that they would be feel proud of, and that's kind of how it got made.
Did you get any cooperation from the military?
Well, I was just going to say the logistics of production. We had no trailers. I mean, it was a very lean, you know, lean production, and we've created these Bedouin tents for the actors, and so it was incredibly stripped down. We had some cooperation and from both the United States military and Jordanian military. And
I think cooperation, though, is a little strong. I mean, they let us come to the base and look around and let the actors talk to EOD. So what we had really was cooperation from within the EOD community.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't as if the Pentagon opened its doors for us the way they do for Transformers and gave us helicopters and, you know, places to detonate 1,000-pound bombs. It was EOD guys who were interested in having their story told.
Interested in having their story told, but having it told accurately. And I think that's why they gave us access.
How many drafts did you go through in writing this script?
I'll never say. There were a few.
Well, there is a sense of extended action here, even if we do have a fair amount of cuts. How much time did you have to shoot some of these things? Were you trying to shoot them as close to real time as possible?
Yeah, we shot it chronologically and well, real time, you know, they do. Bomb Squad goes out 10, 12, 15 times a day, and in any one given day, we're shooting just, you know, 2, 3, 4 pages of a script. So it's a fragment of one of their excursions. But we shot over 44 days and came back with about 1 million feet of film.
Wow. And then what does that get cut down to? That's like shooting a documentary again.
It's like a documentary, exactly. We had
than the normal shooting ratio.
Yeah, the shooting ratio for documentary is probably 80-1. This is about 200-1. But we had four camera units shot on Super 16, which gave the film a very dexterous kind of live look.
And a lot of handheld.
A lot of handheld, exactly.
And you that allows you to show the kind of confusion that can occur. At one point, people in the unit arrive on the scene and say, what are we shooting at? And you got to get that across. You have to make the story clear. At the same time, you have to make it clear that it's unclear.
Yeah, that the random nature of combat and the chaos of it, that is constantly prevalent at every juncture.
That's one of my favorite lines in the movie. I'm glad you brought it up, because you have all these guys shooting and it looks really sort of professional, and you realize they're just pulling the trigger. They don't actually have a target.
The target's like over a mile away. You know, it's virtually invisible.
There's the possibility each time the bomb squad goes out that someone may well die. And so for a viewer in the back of my mind, I'm wondering, so who's it going to be this time? Is that one of the reasons you didn't have big stars, because it's hard to have Tom Cruise killed in the middle of a movie?
It certainly underscores the nature of surprise. And if you're looking at this particular moment in time, combat through the eyes of the soldier, that's all they have. You know, they're not armed with the idea that they're a familiar face and therefore they'll have a heroic death in the last act, if they die at all. So it's that sense of suspense and tension and anticipation.
And it is impossible to kill Tom Cruise, although I think there isn't a director
people
out
have
there
wanted to
who
do
wouldn't,
it.
Who wouldn't want to? Yeah, there's nobody out there who wouldn't want to do it. But the financial constraints of making the movie. If you're paying an actor $20 million, he's got to be in the whole picture.
And plus the opportunity to break emerging talent. You know, I think it's really, really important.
And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the emerging talent that you've broken over the years, Catherine. It's quite extraordinary. Catherine Bigelow is the director of The Hurt Locker. Mark Bull wrote it. It's now playing at the Landmark Sunshine and the AMC Lincoln Square. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Catherine Bigelow, the director of The Hurt Locker, new film now at the Landmark Sunshine and AMC Lincoln Square. Mark Bull is here. He wrote the script, and it's based on experiences he had as an embedded reporter with the bomb squads in Iraq. And I gather that because of the strong response, the film is now going to be in other theaters as well. So
yeah, it's widening out.
That's right. It's also playing in New York. It's playing at the AMC Empire and at the AMC Kips Bay and at the Beekman. So we're moving up in the world.
Now, a listener from Staten Island, Steve, left a question on our show page. He said, from filming the movie and researching the topic, do these men have death wishes, or are they simply inured to the concept of bomb defusing?
Very good question.
And Mark, since you wrote the script and you talked to these guys?
Well, first of all, I would hate to generalize about a whole group of people, but I think death wish might be a little strong. I think that it's like anything else. It's a high-risk occupation, and there's a certain type of person out there that is drawn to the risks and the adrenaline rush that provides, and also the sense of meaning that you get from doing something where you know you're saving lives. It's like being a race car driver or a bull rider or a trauma surgeon. It's high risk, but there's a high reward as well.
Well, the guy who does the most of the defusing, Staff Sergeant James, played by Jeremy Renner, who, by the way, is perfect in this, he takes a box of bombs he's disarmed in the past to wherever he's living. So there is something else going on there. And they're almost like people to him.
Are you familiar with War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, the Chris Hedges book?
Yes.
That was kind of a bit of an inspiration in terms of his character as well.
Well, he talked about the addictive quality of war and living in that kind of stressful situation.
Yeah, and the kind of allure and the attraction of combat and the fact that that's creates almost a hunger that, yeah, not a generalization, just in some individuals that for which there is a desire to replicate after, you know, combat is over.
And it's also that you can find artistry anywhere. You can find people who love their craft anywhere, and it's not just in the occupations we might normally think of. And that's one of the things that struck me when I was in Baghdad, is that the men and women on the bomb squad, and I'm sure in other units this is also true, they take their profession very seriously, and there are some among them who view it as a kind of craft or as an art. And so the fact that they would keep souvenirs of moments that they felt were most successful and interesting and creatively challenging, you know, it was eye-opening to me.
We have a clip from the film involving Staff Sergeant James. Maybe we should give it a listen.
You're the guy in the flaming car, Sergeant James? Afternoon, sir.
Yes, sir.
You're a wild man, you know that?
Yes, sir.
He's a wild man, you know that? Why don't you shake your hand?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure, sir.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked you a question.
873.
873. 873.
They're counting today, sir, yes.
That's got to be a record. What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That's a good one. That's spoken like a wild man.
That's somebody who admires Sergeant James. Not everybody does. Some people think that he's a bit crazy. But I guess we admire wild men, or some of us do.
I think we admire his bravado and his courage and his hubris, but at the same time, his heroism. But we come to learn there's a cost and a price to that heroism.
Well, how did you come to cast Jeremy Renner in the part?
Well, I was familiar with his work, certainly at the point when Mark was finishing the script, and we both looked at what he had done. He had these beautiful, fabulous independent movies, Dahmer, and a number of them, actually. And he really leapt out from the screen and certainly came to my attention, and I felt that he would be had the right ability to kind of combine a reckless nature with a profound skill set and wield that skill set with great authority.
And then you have Anthony Mackie playing Sergeant Sanborn. He's another version of masculinity, but he's the kind of the beta to James's alpha.
He plays by the playbook.
I think he's the person that most people in the audience think is the sanest person there. And then there's a third person. The casting was just extraordinary, but I didn't recognize any of these people. Brian Garrity plays specialist Owen Eldridge, who seems to fluctuate between looking to Sanborn or James as a mentor.
Yeah, he's torn between who to emulate and ultimately perhaps makes the wrong choice.
Well, you've had a pretty good eye for newcomers in the past throughout your career. Gary Busey was in your first film, and then Willem Dafoe received his first screen credit in one of your earliest films.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe, Gary Busey, that's a misprint somewhere, so I worked with him only in Point Break. But I'm sorry. Willem Dafoe, it was...
That's the New York Times getting the story wrong.
I know, I just have
it to does happen.
Figure out
once
where that's
somebody better write
coming
something, the public editor.
Willem Dafoe was in The Loveless, and it was his first film and my first film.
But tell him where you found Willem Dafoe. I think that's an extraordinary story because
he was such a talent.
And
doing these extraordinary performances with the Wooster Group at the Performing Garage, and I went there one night, and he was, of course, dazzling the audience, and came up to him afterward and asked him if he wanted to be in a movie. Now, I'd just done a short film. I had really no credentials in which I could dazzle and encourage him to say yes, but he did. And
And didn't he pretend to be able to drive a motorcycle? It's a motorcycle movie, if you're not familiar with it.
Yeah. He was put on a big Harley Electroglide, which is no small vehicle, and proceeded to drive through a hedge and up the lawn and into the front door of some poor, unsuspecting suburban housewife.
I love that story.
You also had Bill Paxton in Near Dark, Keanu Reeves in Point Break. So in each case, you just saw somebody somewhere and thought, gee, this guy might be good?
Yeah, it's pretty much a kind of an instinctual process, you know, if or at least for me, I don't know, if their ability to convey truth and honesty for any particular character, depending upon what the character needs, and then put them in that situation. I think directing is so much about casting. You can't really, if you've made a sort of erroneous casting choice, no matter how great your camera work or how extraordinary your script or your location or your production design, you can't really compensate for having made the wrong choice.
So how often have you made the wrong choice?
Well, hopefully I think I'm doing all right. So.
And then I was really surprised when I realized that Guy Pearce was playing team leader Sergeant Matt Thompson, because he just disappeared. I thought I spotted Ralph Fiennes, and sure enough, there he was. David Morse also, they appear in cameos along the way. They just did that because they just wanted to help you out? Or they happened to be in Amman, Jordan at the time?
Yeah, they're all just they were coming through the town of Amman. Well, like I said, the battlefield is full of surprises. So,
my guests are Catherine Bigelow and Mark Boll. We're talking about The Hurt Locker, the hit film that is now at the Landmark Sunshine and the AMC Lincoln Square. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Catherine, do you get tired of having to explain why it shouldn't be such a big deal that you're a woman who prefers to direct action films? You told me that when you were at one of the film festivals, some guy pointed at you and said, but you're a woman, but you're a woman.
Well, I suppose I don't look at it as being unique whatsoever. And, you know, I think that maybe because I come from the art world and gender had less play, and, you know, you're just either a painter, you're a filmmaker, you're a sculptor, you're a dancer, whatever your discipline was, that's what or how you chose to define yourself. And I think I kind of have appropriated that in film.
But this is nothing new in films. I mean, George Cukor was pigeonholed as a women's director, for example. I guess it's we just make certain assumptions about how people are, what kinds of films people should do. But how did you wind up doing these films? Is it because you just fell in love with movies and wanted to make the movies that you went to see?
Well, I was interested in using the medium in an experiential way, and it's hard to do with two people talking across a desk. So I, you know, then you begin to search for canvases that give you an opportunity to really kind of prod and expand the medium toward an experiential view of it, I suppose.
Well, you used the word canvas just now. So is one of the reasons you gave up being a painter because you wanted that experiential thing? I mean, you want the ultimate action painting is actually filming action?
Yeah, I think that's probably it.
You just finally hit on it.
I think that's probably a good analysis.
Can you imagine what would have happened if you could continue pursuing your career as a painter?
Or if I had been a still life painter,
a gathering,
like Bierstadt or something. I don't know what that would translate like as a filmmaker, but I don't know. I don't know.
Because it looks like from reading a biography that you could have had real success as a painter.
Well, I was working with a group of artists called Art and Language. I kind of segued from the canvas to conceptual art and then to political art. So already I was sort of moving in another direction and interested in, in the effect of what, you know, the meaning of, you know, those kind of very lofty concerns like the meaning of art and how to justify its existence within the work itself. And so when you start to think in those terms, then, you know, you kind of want to broaden out the ideas in the horizons.
And you've given up painting totally?
Yeah, I don't think I could do it as a hobby.
We talked earlier, Mark, about the addictive nature of war. Chris Hedges wrote a book about it and then decided that he got tired of being addicted. Have you gotten tired of that addiction as well? Or did you ever become totally addicted? After all, you did embed with a bomb squad.
Yeah, I don't think I ever had the addiction problem, but it was definitely one of those things that I was one of those guys that thought it would be an alluring experience to go and check out. And maybe I took my Hemingway too seriously and kind of fell into that romantic trap of all the writers who have sort of made war seem like this great grand adventure or a great test of your courage or something like that. But certainly being there cures you of that pretty quickly. At least it did for me.
Well, in the case of these bomb squad men, they didn't have to be recruited. They volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the same for most people who covered the war?
I don't know. Certainly anyone who went to Baghdad at that time really wanted to go. It was an incredibly
career
dangerous
move if you want to make it as a journalist?
I think it's a career move if you want to be a foreign correspondent, if you're a TV person, certainly was. I mean, for me, being a freelance writer for magazines, I don't think it was much of a career move, but it's really kind of hard to overstate how hard it was to be a journalist there at that time between the constraints the military put on reporting and the fact that Al-Qaeda and various groups had basically declared journalists fair game and, in fact, high-value targets that they would get more coverage from than killing a soldier. I think any journalist who went over there really deserves a lot of... I was there for 5 seconds, but anyone who went and stayed, I think that's pretty extraordinary.
Well, today, if you want to put yourself into that kind of danger, I guess you have to go to Afghanistan. We just heard about a New York Times reporter who climbed over a wall to escape the Taliban, and his story had to be kept secret for
mm-hmm.
a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's, the whole landscape of combat journalism has changed. There was this kind of gentleman's agreement that existed even during the Vietnam War where journalists were considered non-combatants, and nobody really, you could kind of float around as a reporter and not that you were immune from battle. Certainly the photographers, many photographers died during that conflict, but it's really changed in the last 10 years, and you're no longer considered a non-combatant. You're considered an arm of the propaganda machine of the country that's invading you. So So it's become quite a dangerous occupation.
So now that this film is a success, where do you go from here? Catherine, are people throwing projects at you?
Well, there's a certainly, a fair amount of access, because the response to the film has been so incredibly overwhelmingly positive. But I tend to develop material from scratch and hunt out great writers like Mark Bowl and look for material that certainly now has an opportunity to be topical and relevant. I think this Hurt Locker has really kind of opened up that avenue.
I'm not going to ask you what your next project is. You probably don't want to tell anyway.
That's good, because it's still in an embryonic state.
And Mark, ever going back into battle?
I would like to go to Afghanistan. There's a story there that I've been reporting on that will probably eventually take me there. But definitely. And I would like to go back to Baghdad, actually, and be able to walk down some of the streets and buy a cup of coffee in some of the places that I could only really see through 2 inches of bulletproof glass. I think that would be really nice.
Catherine Bigelow is the director of The Hurt Locker. Mark Bull wrote it, and it's now playing at the Landmark Sunshine, the AMC Lincoln Square. And I am informed that it has now been expanded to the Beekman and the AMC Times Square and the Kips Bay. And I thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for
having us. Thank you so much.